On a Monday, it is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It was a busy weekend for politics in America, and we'll size up Wisconsin. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss has requested his chamber's Committee on Campaigns and Elections to investigate how the state election was administered. Voss said in a statement Friday there should be no question as to whether the vote was fair and legitimate. Meanwhile, the Wisconsin Elections Commission has not reported any suspected voter fraud cases in this election. How do you feel about the Assembly Speaker's actions using the legislature's subpoena power to gather testimony to search for irregularities? We're at 800-642-1234. J.R. Ross is editor of wispolitics.com. He's covered state politics for more than 20 years. J.R., welcome back to the Ideas Network.
How are you doing this morning?
Doing well. So Joe Biden won Wisconsin with fewer than 21,000 votes. President Trump's campaign has said there are too many irregularities with Wisconsin's presidential election ballots to trust the outcome. So what is the status of a recount here?
Well, right now what's going on is the counties are going through the canvas process. And in that, basically, all the local clerks go back through their numbers they report on election night, double check everything, send them to the county double checks everything, the county sends an official report to the Elections Commission. I believe it is due sometime next week, but it's often done before that. And the key there is when the last one comes in, the final county canvas report, you have one business day after that until you have to file a request for a recount. So I would guess sometime next week, roughly, we'll know what's going to happen. But at this point, you know, we're not seeing anything that looks out of the ordinary. I mean, it seems like the focus from Trump supporters has been on Milwaukee and with the late swing toward Joe Biden in Wisconsin. But we've been through this before in Wisconsin. Remember, in 2018, kind of similar thing happened. Governor Walker and Tony Evers were in a neck and neck gubernatorial race. All of a sudden, late on Tuesday night, Milwaukee said, hey, we've got a lot more absentee ballots to count. Once those ballots were counted, things went in Tony Evers' direction. Same thing happened here, where I was up all night long last Tuesday. I let Milwaukee finish his count around 3 a.m. It's no surprise, it's a Democratic county. The people who voted by mail were largely Democrats, and those numbers swung toward Joe Biden, and that's provided a big part of the margin that he ended up having. So far, we've seen nothing unusual. And I've seen, you know, people, oh, there were all these ballots where they only had votes for president. That's not unusual in Wisconsin. We have drop off all the time. I haven't looked at yet at the number of ballots with only a presidential vote on them compared to past years, but it happened before. The Milwaukee count was not unusual. It's interesting, the speaker, Robin Voss.
Yeah, I was going to ask you.
He wants to focus on Milwaukee.
Right. On the home front here, what is Assembly Speaker Voss seeking to do?
Well, he wants to, his release on Friday afternoon was that he wanted to look at a quote unquote voter dump, a vote dump, and also look at Milwaukee and its tally. Now, what's kind of interesting is Milwaukee had 161,000 roughly absentee ballots that it counted on Tuesday into Wednesday morning. Green Bay had 31,000 roughly. Green Bay finished 2 hours after Milwaukee, but Green Bay wasn't mentioned by Robin Voss in his release. We don't know why, because he wasn't talking much after putting out the statement. I think it's also important to note that at the same time that Speaker Voss put out that statement, Republican leaders in Michigan and Pennsylvania did similar things. In Michigan, I believe they were going to convene an oversight committee of both houses. Again, Republican-led legislature. In Pennsylvania, the GOP legislative leaders asked the Democratic governor for an audit of the elections. What's in common? Well, they're all three states that are part of the quote-unquote blue wall that President Trump won 4 years ago, that Joe Biden flipped back, and you still have Republican legislatures and Democratic governors. So they're a little bit of the focus of the allegations of something going on that's off. I mean, Pennsylvania, obviously a lot more attention than Wisconsin right now, but This does not seem to be an isolated request by Robin Voss in light of what happened last Tuesday.
We have J.R. Ross, editor of wispolitics.com. We're rewinding on the election and what we know so far. How do you feel about the results in your district? Did any of the results surprise you? Were you satisfied with the outcome of local races? And should there be a recount? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. So JR, Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett told the Journal Sentinel that the allegations of irregularities or voter fraud are hogwash, that they live streamed the counting. They had observers from both parties. It was open to the press. He called Voss's request for an investigation sour grapes. What do you think will transpire at the Capitol?
Well, what we're waiting to hear, Ron Tussler is a Republican from the Appleton area. He's a lawyer. He's the chair of this committee. When I talked to him on Friday, he said he was going to try and figure out a day to meet. He was hoping to do it between the end of that county canvass process and the deadline for a recount. That's a very narrow window.
Yeah.
So unless he misspoke, that's not a lot of time to do much. He hoped to issue subpoenas the next couple of weeks and go from there. But so we don't have a date yet when they're going to meet. We don't know how Democrats are going to, if they're going to participate. We saw a number of statements on Friday, late Friday, from the Democrats on the committee saying this was basically a farce. So we got to watch that. But right now, we don't know how it's going to work. And we were told on Friday by the Speaker's office that more would be released after tomorrow. Tomorrow is a leadership election in the Assembly GOP caucus. So Voss is running for election as Speaker. He is, I believe, going to get a challenge. But people I talk to don't believe it's going to be successful because the Republicans had a pretty decent night last week. So assuming Robin Voss is still Speaker after tomorrow, we will find out then what is going to be the process, maybe some more details about it. And right now, we just don't really know what they're going to do other than this idea of issuing subpoenas, having a committee hearing, and trying to investigate what happened on Tuesday.
Well, speaking of leadership, Senate Republicans elected new leadership in Devin LeMahieu, who was elected the new majority leader, taking over longtime leader Scott Fitzgerald, who's heading to Congress. What will this change in leadership mean for the direction of the state Senate?
To be determined, because, you know, Scott Fitzgerald, if you followed him over the last, decade that he's been running that caucus, you know, Fitzgerald had this kind of this touch with Senate Republicans. While they're all Republicans, they have different factions in that caucus. Mm-hmm. And Fitzgerald was able to let the caucus kind of find its balance. Then he'd come in and seal the deal. I call it the Fitz slow jam. He kind of let them do their work and then figured out the end. And people would always ask Fitzgerald, do you have the votes for Bill X? And say, oh, I don't know. I don't know. And people go, oh my gosh, they don't have the votes yet. Well, actually, Fitz didn't know because he didn't count it yet. He never counted until he had to. And that might seem minor, but it allowed the caucus to feel like it was figuring things out rather than being forced some way. So the question now is with Devin LeMahieu is, can he have that same touch with this caucus? Because in the vote last week, he was running against Roger Roth, a Republican from Appleton. Roger told me there were four votes that tied that went 10-10. Because right now there are 20 members of that caucus, but Fitzgerald didn't vote because he's leaving for Congress in January, right?
Mm-hmm.
There were four straight votes that were 10-10. And then Roger asked for unanimous consent to expunge the record and unanimously elect Devin LeMahieu, the tour leader, which is a super classy move for somebody who wanted something so badly. The question I have now is, okay, there were 10 people who did not want Devin LeMahieu as a tour leader. How is he going to manage a caucus with those that split? How will he bring it together? Who's he going to put in the Joint Finance Committee, for example? This is the Budget Committee. Those are big appointments. There are all these questions about how he's going to lead them going forward. And can he have that same success with that caucus in terms of not directing it, but managing it, the way Fitzgerald did?
Talking with J.R. Ross, editor of WisPolitics.com, looking at Election Day, what happened, and going forward, what 2021 will hold at the state capitol, with your thoughts as well at 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with J.R. Ross and more State Cap on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, it is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We will be taking stock of some of the 180 ballot measures that went before voters on Election Day. In all, 51 local school district referendums were on the ballot, 84% passed. How do you feel about voting on school referendums? Do you think this is the right path for districts to seek extra funding? What about to sustain programs and services? Was a school's question on your ballot? It's 800-642-1234 to join in. J.R. Ross is editor of WisPolitics.com, and he stays with us as our guide this half hour. Let's take a call now. Tom is joining us from Burlington. Hi, Tom. What's on your mind this morning?
I'm in Robin Voss's district. He ran an ad that called his opponent a socialist. And Mr. Voss owns many rental properties, and the rental people can deduct 10% off every year off the cost of their property. It's a subsidy, and no one should be calling someone a socialist. And you guys might want to just look at the rental properties he has and the popcorn business he has. He's done things that are very, very questionable from my point of view, and I wish he'd get along with the Democrats, and let's keep going forward here, because we have Union Grove School has closed down in his district. The COVID is a real, real problem, and people are still spitting people's faces for wearing masks.
Okay, so Tom, I want to pause there and ask JR the question, you know, by Voss asking about the legitimacy of this election by getting the committee on campaigns and elections involved, is he turning the focus to something else and not his district? And what will this do to Voss on the political level?
Well, it is feeding my perception from talking to people, as far as this is about feeding the Trump supporters' belief that something went awry. Now, this could come up that they could go through this process and find nothing went wrong and reaffirm it. But it is in the noise right now of the Trump campaign claiming irregularities without much proof, if any. It's just kind of feeding into that noise right now. So we'll see how that plays out on his front.
So Republicans also elected Chris Kapinga as a Senate president. Mm-hmm. What do we have in Kapinga in this role?
Well, if you add Kapinga and Lemahieu being elected to those two leadership roles, the caucus has taken a turn to the right in terms of its leadership. Now, Scott Fitzgerald is never going to be called a rhino, okay? He is hardcore Republican. He went through the Act 10 fights. He went through right to work. But because he had been through those big battles, he also had the ability to do compromises that you have to do as a leader without losing his credibility. With Lemahieu and Kapinga, you have two guys who are more conservative. And if you look at it, was Fitzgerald and Roth in those two positions this session. Roth was viewed as more of the more moderate wing of the Senate caucus. So the question becomes, how do they, again, manage that caucus, how they interact with Robin Voss and with Governor Evers? There's a perception of people I talked to that the election of Devin and Chris was about some members of that Republican Senate caucus wanting somebody they thought would stand up to Robin Voss. Robin has been the Capitol now for, elected 2004 the first time. He was an aide before that. He's been around politics for a long time. Fitzgerald had been around longer than that. Now you have a new leader against Robin Voss, who is this seasoned veteran, right? I get the perception they want somebody who they felt could stand up to Robin, not be bulldozed by him in trying to negotiate things on the budget or various legislation, especially with the dynamic that they have with Governor Evers, where Governor Evers is up for re-election in 2022, and how Republicans try to either work with him or undermine him the next 2 years.
Mm. We're talking with WIS Politics editor J.R. Ross as we discuss the election, the makeup of the state capitol heading into 2021, and the dynamics, the optics, with your insights, 800-642-1234. J.R., I want to turn now to the referenda, and starting with the Madison School District, which passed two referendums Tuesday by more than 50%, slightly more support for the capitol referendum. What will these additional funds mean for the school district?
Massive remodels of the four high schools. My oldest son's at La Follette. I've coached a lot of youth sports in Madison, been in the high school and the middle schools a lot in gym space. Just basically spruce them up, make them more functional, redo a lot of the HVAC systems, aging infrastructure, the whole nine yards. So the large part is going to do stuff like that.
How did other school referenda do on Tuesday?
Well, looking back at my notes, we had about 2/3 of the referendum that were approved, roughly. There's $1.2 billion on the ballot, according to one of my colleagues. Interesting note, In 2020, I believe we had nearly $3 billion in school referendums on the ballot. What's happening is, if you think about it, under former Governor Walker and Republicans, they went through a process where they tried to limit property taxes. We call it buying down the levy. What I mean by that is you have all these programs in government in Wisconsin where there's a mix of state dollars and local property tax dollars. The more state dollars you put in, and these caps we have on spending, the less you rely on property taxes. And Scott Walker was very much dedicated to trying to keep the property tax bill down. But by doing that, and homeowners not seeing the property tax bill go up, it probably helps set the stage for districts to be able to successfully push for this referendum, because people are going, okay, well, I see the schools, and in my mind, they're not doing as great as they should. My property tax bill has not been going up. I'm okay with an extra $20 a year or $50 a year. So in a way, Republicans kind of trying to hold down property taxes paved the way for locals to approve raising their own property taxes.
The village of Heartland in Waukesha County had an $8.5 million funding referendum on the ballot for their high school that just narrowly squeaked by. Was this one controversial?
Yeah, and actually, if you look, the school referendums that didn't pass are largely in more Republican areas. I think Wausau is another place that had some referendum that failed. It's, you know, if you think about it, a lot of these Republican areas are a little less thrilled with the idea of paying more property taxes. So that is a barrier to these districts, with the sentiment from voters of, you know, I'm not really thrilled about the idea of raising my property taxes for X, Y, and Z. You should live within your means because you already have X, Y, and Z.
Let's bring in Steve now in Sun Prairie with thoughts on the referendums. Hi, Steve.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yes, these referendums over the past 8 years or so have just been so out of control, with districts pushing and pushing for more. Has there ever been any discussion about any referendum that goes through, there would be some type of pro rata decrease in the amount of state aid? Let those places pay their own taxes as opposed to spreading it across the rest of the state.
Steve, thanks.
Yes.
Yeah, JR, go ahead.
Yeah, that's actually one that there's been a discussion about, that how to try and limit what the state picks up if you locals approve their own property tax, or having it decrease state funding in some way. There's been talk about a cooling off period, that if you do a referendum, how long you'd have to wait till you could go back to voters again, because we've seen multiple districts that fail one time, tweak it, wait for a different election, come back again. We see proposals about limiting when you can ask voters to weigh in on a referendum and making it be a certain elections. So these are all Republican ideas about doing things to try and rein in this local control. Now, with Republicans control of both houses of legislature and Democratic Governor Tony Evers, those things aren't going to pass, because Governor Evers is going to argue that locals have it's local control. If locals want to increase their property taxes, they should have that option. Remember, Governor Evers is a former state superintendent of education. So I don't see any of those changes or any new ideas being approved in the next 2 years. But that's something to keep an eye on if and when Republicans have full control again, if they try and do things like that.
11 counties had non-binding referenda that asked about redistricting, changing the way we draw our political maps. What did you see there?
You know, they've proven popular. Every time they've been on the ballot, people like the idea of it. In practice, nothing's going to change. Republican lawmakers are not going to approve anything that would give up the power to draw those maps. Number two, the governor tried to do like a little bit of an end around legislature with this people's commission, these people's maps, he's calling them. What that's really about is he's having these hearings around the state to get input on a set of maps. That's all about the court fight that's going to happen in 2021. At some point, lawmakers may try and draw maps next year. Governor Evers will almost surely veto them. Then we'll go to court. So the question is, which court will draw the maps, the state Supreme Court or a federal court? What I'm guessing is that Governor Evers' People's Commission, the maps that commission produces, will present the court, say, here's an option for you to put a map in place that was drawn in a nonpartisan way that you can embrace. Whereas Republicans say, okay, here's our version of the maps. Democrats say, well, here's our version of the maps. And the court will have to choose or draw its own lines. Courts aren't really set up to draw lines on their own. They don't have map makers, you know, in the regular employ. So they may end up just picking a map submitted to them. This is what that process is all about.
And so basically these referenda are just basically non-binding and therefore, mm-hmm. you know, therefore show?
Yeah. I mean, like, look, they're expressing the voters' interest. The voters okay. don't like this idea, but you're not going to influence Robin Voss with a non-binding referendum about redistricting. Because remember, having covered government for a long time, this is the most political thing you can do in government that's legal. And Robin Voss has not given up that power to somebody that's not elected to draw those maps.
JR, thank you for joining us.
Anytime.
JR Ross, editor of WisPolitics.com. Coming up, the State Capitol Report continues with a look at the status of Marcy's Law, a type of crime victims constitutional amendment that voters ratified in April. Now a judge says the ballot question was improper. We talk with one of the plaintiffs challenging the law right after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A Dane County judge ruled last week that a ballot measure from April's election meant to protect crime victims' rights was improperly worded and should be rescinded. Voters overwhelmingly adopted the language of what's known as Marcy's Law in the spring election. Did you find the April ballot question about Marcy's Law confusing? Do you remember it? Did you understand what you were voting on? Wording aside, what do you think of Marcy's Law? And what questions do you have about what it does? We're at 800-642-1234. Jerome Buting is a Wisconsin criminal defense attorney. He's among the plaintiffs challenging Marcy's Law. Jerome, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Good morning. Glad to be here.
So explain how this ballot measure was misleading to voters.
Well, you know, we filed suit before the election asking for a temporary restraining order that removed the ballot, given the wording that it had. The judge denied the motion for the restraining order, temporary restraining order, but allowed the legal arguments to go forward. There was briefing all summer, oral arguments, and then the judge issued a really, you know, well-reasoned, compelling decision about the problems, all of which we had raised in our suit. And, you know, one of them was, you know, the legislature can allow the voters to choose to amend their constitution, but they have to present a fair question to the voters so that they know what they're voting on. And if there's more than one issue that's being changed in the constitution, there has to be separate questions so that the voters can vote up on one, down on the other, or whatever. And in this case, the court concluded that there, because of the effect of the amendment, there should have been more than one question presented. One question was needed to ask the voters if they wanted to expand crime victims' rights, but another question needed to have been asked of the voters about whether they wanted to remove from the Constitution protections of those accused of crimes, including the right to a fair trial, which is the effect of this amendment. The other problem with the ballot question was it was misleading because it told the voters that victims' rights and the rights of the accused would be protected equally. That's the term in the question.
Essentially what this whole Marcy's Law was about, equalizing the rights of a victim with those of a defendant. Carry on.
Correct. Correct. And that was, you know, the debates and the discussions in the legislature. That was purportedly all they wanted to do. But the language in the actual amendment is different. It says that the victim's rights should be protected no less vigorously than those of the accused. Well, really what that means is equal to or more than the accused, the rights of the accused. Under the amendment, that's what the language means. And the voters weren't told that in fact, victims' rights could be enforced more than equally over the accused if there a conflict arises.
But more than 75% voted in favor of the Marcy's Law state constitutional amendment. And you can assert that voters didn't understand what they were fully voting for, but they wanted Marcy's Law. How can a small cadre of lawyers undo the will of the people?
Well, because the we have very clear and very firm methods for amending the Constitution. You don't just amend the Constitution every day. Voters have to know what they're voting on.
How do you know they didn't know?
Well, because the language is not clear enough, there's a presumption they didn't know. That's what our case law says. You can't let them vote on, you know, getting a pig in a poke, voting for one thing and then be told, oops, you actually voted for something else. I mean, that's fundamentally unfair to the voters. And that's really what happened here. One other ruling the court made about that was problematic with the question was the question said that they would protect the federal constitutional rights of the accused, but they said nothing about removing state constitutional rights of the accused. And that is, in fact, what the amendment did. So there's a whole, a whole panoply of rights in the state constitution and statutory rights that the accused have always had that would now be removed by this amendment, and including the right to a fair trial. The language was specifically stricken that required a under state constitution a right for a defendant's fair trial. Now, I just don't think voters, maybe they wanted to do that. It may be that they wanted to elevate victims' rights above the defendant's rights and even remove the right to a fair trial, but I doubt that. And if so, it should have been said clearly in the question so that we knew what we were voting on.
Do you think prosecutors gained rights with Marcy's Law, making your job more difficult in criminal defense?
Actually, prosecutors didn't gain any rights. The real problem is, the confusion that's resulted. Prosecutors got no more money, by the way. This is an unfunded mandate. And they're now, everybody's scrambling, trying to understand just what the effect of this is. It varies from county to county. It does affect defendants' rights, and it does make our right to defend people accused of crimes, innocent people accused of crimes included, more difficult because, for instance, some district attorney's offices are taking the position that we can't give you even police reports that were always discoverable without redacting the names and addresses of the witnesses. That's very problematic. The law typically requires, yes, in certain instances that could be permitted. You could get what's called a protective order, but the responsibility was for the prosecutors to go to the court, explain why in this instance, this particular reason, we think maybe the alleged victim is in danger or something like that. And then the court can take those kinds of measures. But some prosecutors are doing it across the board. It's even difficult for criminal defense attorneys to know whether there's a conflict of interest now, because it's possible that we could have represented somebody related to or associated with the accuser in their case, and they just used initials. We don't even know who the names of some of the people are. Go ahead.
I was just going to reintroduce you. We're talking with Jerome Buting, who is a criminal defense attorney, one of the plaintiffs challenging the Marcy's Law amendment to the state constitution over flaws to how it was worded. You can join in. Do you support Marcy's Law? Do you remember it on the ballot in April? What did you think of it? And did you find that April's ballot question was confusing? Would you support a revote? Join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Mary joining us from La Crosse. Hi, Mary. What was your interpretation?
When that was on the ballot, I was confused, and I don't remember now if I knew it was even on the ballot ahead of time, and it was one of these questions that was very hard to interpret, but I thought it sounded like a good idea, sounded as though it was something I should vote for. So I did vote for it, but then after that, I asked my daughter about it, who was a career, now retired, probation and parole agent, and she said, no, I shouldn't have voted for it, and she explained to me the reasons, and I'm vague on those reasons now, but it was unfortunate that something became part of the Constitution that we truly did not understand.
Mary, thank you for that. And, you know, Jerome, the irony of a referendum is that while it typically asks voters to check a simple yes or no, it's actually one of the most complicated forms of voting. The policy issues at stake, understanding the wording, the legalese. Will Murphy's Law be put before voters again?
Well, the judge has made his ruling now. And by the way, let me just make it clear that the Wisconsin Justice Initiative and the other plaintiffs, including myself, we're not challenging the underlying principle of trying to protect alleged victims' rights. There's some substance in the question or in the amendment itself that is poorly worded and could be corrected, I think, if it ever comes back before the voters. But the problem was the way the voting public was told what was happening with this amendment. And other states had rejected the Marcy's Law, and one state repealed them. Another had to go back and amend them because they were all adopted with these serious flaws. The amendment came from this national movement from this billionaire out in California, and they were submitting the proposal and the questions to every state, and people just weren't really clearly told what was happening. Now, if this judge's decision stands and the state could appeal it, then it would have the effect of invalidating this vote, and the legislature would then could come back and do it again, but they would have to do it in a way so that the voting public knows what they're voting on.
Yeah, and you've been opposing this Murphy's Law for years now, and I'm wondering here, the optics of this, right? Failing to write a good ballot question is about much more than writing good questions. Are you concerned that this challenge could drive criticism and maybe apathy among voters? They're asking me this question, but does it matter ultimately because it ends in the hands of lawyers?
Well, one of the problems that I've always had with the whole idea of a constitutional right, a victim's rights amendment, is that most people don't understand the relationship between alleged victims and the courts and the prosecutors. Some victims have complained that the existing statutory rights of victims, and they've had those for a long time. Wisconsin was one of the first states to do that. Some complained that they weren't satisfactory and that they weren't being properly honored and that they couldn't get a hold of advocates on their behalf. And one of the problems is that there's been a reduced funding for victim witness advocates in the courts. It was originally the states were going to reimburse counties for 90%. That went down now to something like less than 50%, maybe 42% of the costs, while the counties are required to shoulder this expense. And that's where the problem was.
Let's pause there on funding with Jerome Buting challenging the Murphy's Law amendment to the Wisconsin State Constitution. And we'll be back in just a moment on the Ideas Network. It's a State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The effort to pass crime victims' rights legislation is a national effort. As of this year, Murphy's Law is on the books in at least 10 states, including in Wisconsin. A Dane County judge last week wrote a 36-page ruling essentially saying that the way the ballot measure was worded was misleading to voters. 75% of voters approved the state constitutional amendment in April. What should happen next with Murphy's Law? Join in 800-642-1234. Attorney Jerome Buting is one of the plaintiffs challenging the law. He stays with us for 10 more minutes. Let's bring in Michelle now in Racine. Hi, Michelle. What did you think of the ballot measure?
Well, I remember when I downloaded my sample ballot, I read it and I turned to my husband and I said, what does this even mean? Like, it was such obvious leading language. It was clearly steering the voter. So we both started trying to look it up and get some clarity. And we found an ACLU article opposing the measure. And that's what inspired us to vote against it.
So Michelle looked at what outside groups were saying about the ballot measure in order to figure out what it was all about, Jerome.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, I've heard from people that they had a hard time finding the actual language of the proposed amendment and the explanation behind it. Now, there were officially published so that voters could go beyond the ballot question if they really chose. But many people showed up at the polls and hadn't even seen the question until they got there, and so therefore didn't have time to go online and look up what some of the problems are. And Michelle is absolutely right. It was very leading the way the question was worded. And it's like, who wouldn't vote for this? I'm kind of amazed that even 25% of the people even voted against it, given the misleading wording of the question. Maybe those 25% had done a little research ahead of time, but that is the problem.
Let's fast forward to today. Months later, Marcy's Law has been in effect since the amendment passed in the spring. How has it been working?
Well, there's been a lot of confusion, and it's varied from one county to the next. The amendment is broadly worded, but there was no implementing laws, statutes that could give guidance to the circuit courts and to the district attorneys and public defenders and private attorneys how to proceed. For instance, some counties interpreted that they have to delay any release on bail for a defendant charged at the very first court appearance if the victim isn't present. Even if it's, a case that's really not going to be in dispute, that a defendant will be released at some point, and there could be conditions, no contact, and those kinds of things that we've always had. But so people are sitting in jail longer than otherwise. I mentioned the problem with discovery that's turned over. Interestingly, though, the Court of Appeals now just ruled last week in a case that is not yet published, but it will be in all likelihood. It's recommended, and then it'll be binding. And they ruled that a alleged victim can intervene in a pending case in pretrial motions and can be represented by an attorney in doing so. And so now we have a situation set up where there's a socioeconomic class bias, because only people who can afford attorneys, only alleged victims who can afford their own private attorneys will be able to do this, whereas anybody who's indigent or just cannot afford to hire their own attorney to go in cannot. And so there's no funding in the amendment that allows for representation at state cost for alleged victims. And by the way, let me point out one thing that maybe some of the listeners may not understand. The amendment also defined the person who's making the accusation as a victim from the beginning, when in fact that is often, at least in many cases, that is the ultimate question that a jury must decide. Is the person a victim? Was there a crime at all? Was it a self-defense?
The legislation doesn't change any of the accused constitutional rights.
It does. It takes away all of the state constitutional rights.
So you believe calling a victim is basically not, what do you call them then?
Well, they're an alleged victim. It's up to the jury to decide if they are an actual victim or not. Many cases, that is, there's some cases it's not in dispute. Somebody was victimized by somebody. There's no question. But other times, there is a serious question that jurors decide, or judges if it goes to a court trial. Did a crime occur at all? And so you're putting the cart before the horse the way this amendment is worded, and that's problematic. But that goes again to the substance of the change more than the actual wording of the change. So there are many. I mean, we've seen just in the few months that the ballot has been in effect, much confusion about how it will apply. Variation on how it applies from one county to the next. And the courts really aren't given a lot of guidance. That's one of the things that Judge Remington pointed out. They'd had a whole series of case law that would help guide them on how to balance. I mean, there was always the question of if there's a conflict between the privacy, let's say, of an alleged victim and that of a accused defendant, the courts would have to balance those interests. And in the instance, for instance, sometimes if there's mental health records of a accused or text messages, of the accuser, the complainant, or text messages from that person to the defendant relevant to the time of their encounter.
Well, what's relevant may be entirely extremely invasive of the alleged victim.
Well, and the way we've always protected that is that you have to file a motion. You can't, as a defense attorney, as a defendant, you can't just go fishing in their private records. You have to file a motion that shows the judge there's good reason to believe that there's something that's relevant. Relevant to the defense, to the constitutional right of the accused to defend him or herself. And then the judge would look at those records privately in chamber and only turn them over to either the defense or the state if he or she concluded that, yes, this is very relevant information, without which that a defendant's right to a fair trial would be abridged. So only in those circumstances does that happen. There has to be a balancing. Now, under this new amendment that allows a alleged victim's rights to be protected more than equal, more than those of the accused, that balance may tip in their favor. And, you know, then we have the risk of innocent people being wrongly convicted.
Well, I want to
because
pause.
Evidence.
I want to be able to get in one more call here. Mike in Madison, go ahead with Jerome Buting.
Good morning. I want to preface this by saying the law has a morally good premise. Nobody in abusing any kind of victimized situation wants to look across at their abuser. But the law itself actually takes away many, many of our constitutional rights, such as due process, cross-examination. Basically, you have no right to prove your innocence. You are guilty in this case until proven innocent, and it denies your options to prove your innocence. And I was wondering if your guest could get into a little more of the specifics on the legal aspect of this.
Jerome Buting, 30 seconds.
Sure. So federal constitutional rights to due process are still protected, but the Wisconsin state constitutional protections are not. Including, the only place in the Constitution previously that actually protected a defendant's right to a fair trial has now been eliminated by this amendment. So, it will be more difficult for the accused to defend themselves if, in fact, courts begin to weigh and balance and keep from jurors evidence that otherwise would be the best evidence. Text messages is a perfect example where there's communications between the parties. The jury should be able to hear, see that if it's relevant, only those portions that are relevant to the accusations. And, that may be more difficult to get nowadays.
Jerome, thank you for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Jerome Buting, a defense attorney among the plaintiffs challenging Marcy's Law brought by the Wisconsin Justice Initiative. Just ahead, we speak with an infectious disease specialist on the COVID-19 surge in Wisconsin. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the State Capitol Report, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.